A truck carrying what was described as a mind-boggling stack of documents arrived at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission early this morning. The paperwork is the long-awaited application for a license to build a nuclear waste dump under Yucca Mountain in Nevada. The government has been researching the site for over 20 years. President Bush and Congress approved it in 2002, but the lawsuits and political fights continue. Today's license application took the project a small, hard-fought step forward. NPR's David Kestenbaum reports.
The application fit on one DVD, but printed out, it made an impressive bit of paperwork. Energy Secretary Samuel Bodman held a press conference. Before him, on a long table, were binder after binder, like a huge encyclopedia.
This application represents the culmination of over 20 years of work by some of the nation's leading scientists, engineers, and technical experts.
To actually get the license, the government has to show, with computer models and all those documents, that the repository won't leak more than a small amount of radioactive material into the groundwater over the ages. How far into the future hasn't been decided, but the Environmental Protection Agency is considering a new rule which would set limits that would apply 1 million years into the future. Secretary Bodman said the application showed the repository would meet even that tough standard.
We have done our level best. We believe it can be done, or we wouldn't be standing here before you today.
The license will face many challenges. The state of Nevada has doggedly fought the project at every turn and says it will contest the license application on hundreds of points. And, of course, Nevada has a powerful voice in the Senate. Majority Leader Harry Reid from Nevada recently helped cut funding for the project.
This is bad from the beginning to the end. This whole process is doomed to failure. There's no chance Yucca Mountain is going to be the place for siting nuclear waste.
Reid favors leaving the waste where it is now, in big metal containers at the nuclear power plants. By law, the U.S. government was required to begin picking up the waste from power plants 10 years ago. It didn't because it didn't have any place to put it. As a result, electrical utilities filed over 60 lawsuits. Jerry Stock is handling 10 of those. He's an attorney with the firm Greenberg Traurig, and he's happy the license application was finally submitted today.
It's a significant milestone, a very significant milestone, on the way towards the opening of the repository. But the licensing process will have to, you know, take place now, and that's also a significant undertaking. That's going to take several years.
And every year costs the government more money. At the end of 2007, the U.S. had paid out $290 million to compensate utilities for the expense of storing the waste locally. The government has spent almost $100 million in legal fees alone. While the announcement was a milestone for some, it left Eric Herzig a little bored. He's a political scientist at the University of Nevada and has watched the Yucca saga for over a decade.
Well, it's just another step in this seemingly interminable project's path towards being licensed.
Do you think eventually it will be licensed?
That still remains to be seen. I mean, sometimes it seems like it's about to die, then other times it seems like it's going to be fast-tracked. It really is hard to predict what's going to happen, whether or not this ultimately will open.
The Department of Energy today said the earliest the nuclear waste repository could open would be 2020. David Kestenbaum, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
World leaders gathered in Rome today to talk about the worldwide food crisis. The United Nations Secretary General called for lowering trade barriers and removing export bans. He was speaking on the first day of the UN Summit on Food Security. Those discussions were somewhat obscured by the presence of two world leaders, whom many consider pariahs, Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe and Iran's Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, or FAO, originally called the summit to deal with risks climate change is posing to food security. But soaring food prices and food riots in several countries forced a shift in focus. In his opening remarks, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said more than 850 million people in the world are short of food, and that the World Bank estimates that figure could rise by a further 100 million.
The world needs to produce more food. Food production needs to rise by 50% by the year 2030 to meet the rising demand. We have an historic opportunity to revitalize agriculture, especially in countries where productivity gains have been low in recent years.
Ban Ki-moon said wealthy nations have been spending billions of dollars on farm subsidies, wasteful and excess consumption of food, and on arms.
Some countries have taken action by limiting exports or by imposing price controls. They only distort markets and force prices even higher. I call on nations to resist such measures and to immediately release exports designated for humanitarian purposes.
The summit's two most difficult issues are likely to be the generous farm subsidies paid by wealthy nations to their own farmers and biofuels, often made by converting foodstuffs into fuel, which some experts singled out as a major culprit behind the food crisis. But the first day of the summit was dominated by two persona non grata on the international stage. The presence of Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe outraged many Western leaders who blame him for the economic collapse of a country once considered the breadbasket of Southern Africa. But Mugabe defended his widely criticized land policies.
Thus, over the past decade, Zimbabwe has democratized the land ownership patterns in the country, with over 300,000 previously landless families now proud landowners. It has, however, and regrettably so, elicited wrath from our former colonial masters.
And he came to blame the West for trying to cripple his country's economy.
Funds are being channeled through non-governmental organizations to the opposition political parties, which are a creation of the West. Further, these Western-funded NGOs also use food as a political weapon with which to campaign against government, especially in the rural areas.
For Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, the summit gave him the opportunity to come to Europe for the first time as his country's president. Besides addressing the plenary session, he also held a long press conference in which he made his latest virulent attack on Israel, which he claims will soon be wiped off the map.
This will happen for sure. This will happen whether we are involved in it or not.
Both Mugabe and Ahmadinejad are being kept out of the summit's social events. Neither has been invited to tonight's ceremonial dinner. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne at NPR West with Steve Inskeep in Karachi, Pakistan. The global warming debate has landed in Congress and in the laps of everyone who uses or produces energy. Late yesterday, the Senate voted to take up a massive proposal to reduce greenhouse gases. It would require factories, utilities, and refineries to pay for the right to emit carbon dioxide. In a moment, we'll tell you about the fight over the trillions of dollars that this cap-and-trade system will cost. First, to the lawmakers, with NPR's Brian Naylor.
The Senate kicked off what could be as many as 2 weeks of debate on a climate change bill that even its backers concede is unlikely to attract the 60 votes it will need to gain approval. To be sure, it has many supporters on both sides of the aisle. Democratic Senator Barbara Boxer of California called it a tripartisan measure.
It is a Democratic, it is independent, it is Republican. It reflects this country. And when it comes to this issue, we have to turn away from partisanship, because this is about our children and their children. It's about the planet that we have inherited, and we must listen to the scientists.
The bill the Senate is debating aims to cut the emissions of greenhouse gases 19% below current levels by 2020 and 71% by 2050. It would do so by creating a carbon market. There, power plants and industries that produce greenhouse gases could trade allowances they'd be given or buy in auctions. The revenue generated by the auctions would be used for everything from training for green-collar jobs to mass transit and low-income tax relief. The measure's Republican co-sponsor, Senator John Warner of Virginia, harkened back to an earlier era as a metaphor for the bill.
I look upon this global climate change effort as if it were a great, big, mighty steam railroad engine in a station, ready to go. Boilers burning, ready to start its journey down the track. And I'd be the first to tell you, I cannot predict every twist and turn in that track. But I do say, unreservedly, take the hands off the brake. Let the train start.
Of course, opponents hope to derail Senator Warner's locomotive. Their argument, it will raise energy prices and cost the economy trillions of dollars in lost economic growth. Many Republicans quoted from a Wall Street Journal editorial yesterday, calling the measure the largest income redistribution scheme since the income tax. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
At a time when Americans are struggling to pay their bills and when the price of gas seems to be rising higher and higher every day, the majority is showing itself to be laughably out of touch by moving to a bill that would raise the price of gas even higher.
Republicans argued the bill makes no allowance for emissions from countries such as India and China, whose fast-growing economies are producing their own greenhouse gases. Republican Senator Christopher Bond of Missouri said the bill favors some regions of the U.S. at the expense of others.
The pain will be focused primarily on the coal-dependent, manufacturing job-heavy Midwest, South, and Great Plains.
President Bush weighed in against the measure, and the White House says he'll veto the climate change bill if it reaches his desk. But in many ways, the Senate debate is about setting the stage for the next administration. Both Democratic presidential candidates Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton support the measure. The Republicans' presumptive presidential nominee, Senator John McCain of Arizona, has long been a proponent of steps to reduce greenhouse gases. But he said he wants more in the bill to encourage use of nuclear energy. His ally, Connecticut Independent Democrat Joseph Lieberman, a co-sponsor of the measure, says he's confident McCain will come around.
He'll have the final decision, but he's been part of this from the very beginning. And I expect that at the end of this, when the critical vote occurs, he'll be with us.
Senator Warner says he intends to offer an amendment that would encourage nuclear energy research and job training. The House, meanwhile, is working on its own climate change legislation and is likely to hold hearings later this month on a different approach, a carbon tax. Brian Naylor, NPR News, the Capitol.
And as we just heard, the Climate Security Act, as it stands, may be too controversial to win approval, mostly because of fears about how much it will cost. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on the kind of money that's at stake.
The Climate Act would shift a lot of money from one part of the economy to another. Industries that emit greenhouse gases, mostly electric utilities, heavy industry, and refineries, will have to start paying the government for permits to do that. And that will raise about $6 trillion by 2050. The idea is to transfer some of that to consumers who would be paying more for energy because of the permitting system. And the government would also use the money to push clean technologies to make energy without emitting greenhouse gases. Economist Vicky Arroyo at the Pew Center on Global Climate Change says the government has tried this kind of thing before.
We made a false start at it in the 70s when there were long lines at gas stations, and Jimmy Carter made his now famous speech with the sweater on, urging people to change their behavior, and also, frankly, investing unprecedented amounts in renewables and new forms of fuel. But with the low prices that we've seen for the decades since, and the lack of a political will here, we really didn't follow that path.
Oil, coal, and natural gas, the major sources of CO2, are not cheap anymore. So the idea of using less of those fossil fuels should get more traction this time around, or so argue the climate bill's supporters. Those who oppose have their doubts. People like Kenneth Green, an environmental analyst for the American Enterprise Institute in Washington.
It's not very hard math to say $1 trillion divided by 300 million Americans is this many dollars per American. And once those numbers start being generated and start being publicized, the public's not going to be amused. I mean, every poll suggests people do not want to pay more for greenhouse gas reductions. They don't want to pay more in gas taxes. They don't want to pay higher energy rates. They just don't want to pay.
Lots of economists have been trying to figure out just what the cost to consumers or to the economy would be if this bill becomes law. As you might expect, those figures vary widely. The National Association of Manufacturers, which adamantly opposes the bill, says a typical household could lose almost $7,000 a year in income by 2030. But the Natural Resources Defense Council counters that without some limit on greenhouse gases, the consequences, more hurricane damage, higher water costs, damage to agriculture, could cost Americans close to $2 trillion a year. And the group argues that finding replacements for fossil fuels will create new industries and new jobs. One way to look at the projected cost is to compare it to higher prices Americans already are experiencing. Vicky Arroyo points to the cost of a gallon of gas.
This bill basically suggests a 25-cent increase in about 2025 or 2030, as opposed to the, you know, dollar-plus increase that we've seen in recent months.
An increase that people are not happy about, but are generally able to bear. As for the hit the whole economy will take, the Environmental Protection Agency recently calculated that the bill would slow the annual gross domestic product by as much as 7% by 2050. But by then, the GDP will still have grown by 215%. The bill supporters say that's not such a bad hit then. Its opponents say it's way too much. A lot of energy experts do agree that without some as yet undiscovered new technology, energy is going to cost more. Among them is John Holdren, a professor of environmental policy at Harvard University.
Throughout the history of the development and expansion of fossil fuels, society was getting the benefits of these versatile, convenient, inexpensive, concentrated sources of energy and not paying the full cost.
Estimates of the full cost of the Climate Act will have to wait until Congress comes up with a finished version months or years from now. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Hear how climate change is affecting the world from Barrow, Alaska to Alice Springs, Australia. Just dig into the archives of our series Climate Connections at npr.org/climate. The global food crisis has hit hard in one Middle Eastern country. Yemen sits at the bottom of Saudi Arabia's peninsula, facing Africa across a thin channel of water. It's one of the poorest countries in the world, and it's being hit hard by severe droughts and depleted water supplies. The government is already struggling to deal with political unrest, and now some Yemenis are calling the food situation a potential time bomb. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Just west of the capital Sana'a, the terrain grows rugged as you climb the Haraz Mountains, home to the highest peak in the Middle East, more than 12,000 feet above sea level. Normally in the spring, the magnificent terraced hillsides here would be lushly dressed in shades of green, covered with fruit orchards, coffee bushes, and the ubiquitous khat trees, whose mildly stimulating leaves are chewed by Yemenis for hours on end. But this year, except for a few lightly irrigated patches, the view is mostly a hazy brown, spotted with a few blackened areas, the charred remains of controlled burns that indicate another farmer has given up for this season. A small herd of sheep sniffs among the dust-covered bushes for something to eat, watched over by a 65-year-old woman in an orange scarf and a bright fuchsia dress. Perhaps counterintuitively, in Yemen, it's the urban women who tend to wear the niqab, the full black Muslim covering that leaves only the eyes visible. In the countryside, many women still wear the more colorful traditional clothes and leave their faces uncovered. This shepherdess is also not shy about speaking her mind, readily interrupting her son as she talks about the drought and what it's doing to the way of life here. She says in the past month, 5 of the 25 sheep she tends have died.
It's hard, very hard this year. There's no rain, and the plants that the sheep eat are dry. The sheep are dying, the plants are dying, there's nothing else to do. We wait for the rain. That's what we always do.
Once a month, the government pumps water up from below to fill the water tanks in the village of Hajara, one of the most dramatically situated towns in Yemen. It's perched atop a rocky cliff, accessible only by footpath. Hajara was once home to a good number of Yemen's historically large Jewish population. Most Yemeni Jews have since relocated to Israel or elsewhere, but their work lives on among a dwindling number of silversmiths who still make traditional Yemeni jewelry. 68-year-old Sheikh Abdullah Hussein Khalil has been the local authority in Hajara for some 40 years, following in the footsteps of his father and grandfather before him. He wears typical Yemeni male attire, white desert robes with a ceremonial dagger in the front of his belt, topped with a Western-style sport coat. His eyes sparkle as he offers strong spiced coffee and sweet tea to a visitor, but he grows somber when the conversation turns to Yemen's three biggest shortages, food, water, and tourists.
This year, with no rain, nothing's growing. The coffee, the corn, the wheat, the cot, nothing. A couple of years ago, we might get as many as 150 tourists in a day, sometimes twice that. But now it's only a few, and some days, none at all.
The World Bank has described Yemen as the single largest development challenge in the Middle East, and that was before the recent weather-related problems. As in many poor corners of the world, Yemenis are finding the cost of staple foods rising and their ability to pay for them sorely tested. There have yet to be riots over food shortages, as in Haiti or Egypt, but officials say the warning signs are growing. One Yemeni cabinet minister says the government's ability to deal with the crisis is limited. This is a very dangerous time, he says, adding that he hopes the U.S. and other developed countries will realize that economic strife can lead to radicalization. Yemen's per capita share of developmental assistance is well below the global average, despite its severe poverty. Analysts say this is partly the government's own fault for failing to enact political reforms upon which some aid is conditioned, notably the Bush administration's Millennium Challenge grant. Other aid has been suspended or delayed over the Bush administration's anger at Yemen's freeing of convicted terrorists, including one of the men involved in the 2000 bombing of the USS Cole that killed 17 American sailors at the port of Aden. Former Yemeni Prime Minister Abdul Karim al-Iryani, who at age 73 has been described as one of the architects of modern Yemen, usually takes a sunny view of Yemen's potential. But at the moment, when he looks at the drought, rising food prices, the reluctance of foreign donors, and growing political unrest, he sees trouble ahead for his country.
I'm very pessimistic, frankly, for the next 2 to 3 years. Nature and man are squeezing Yemen, and I think this alarm bell should ring in various corners around us and in the United States as well.
Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Sana'a.
Today, NASA's Inspector General confirmed allegations that the space agency's press office downplayed findings about global warming. The report says the agency softened press releases between 2004 and 2006 and improperly blocked journalists from speaking with a key climate scientist. But the Inspector General says NASA did not attempt to interfere with scientific research about climate change. For more on the report, we're joined by NPR's Richard Harris. And Richard, what led to this investigation of NASA's Public Affairs Office in the first place?
Well, Melissa, this story may sound familiar because it's been talked about over the last couple of years. 2.5 years ago, actually, a climate scientist, NASA's James Hansen, provided a provocative and actually fairly political talk at a big scientific meeting. And when journalists said they wanted to talk to him afterwards, they went to the Public Affairs Office, and the Public Affairs Office said no. So eventually that news hit the New York Times and other news organizations. And as a result of that hue and cry, Congress called hearings. And as a result of all of that, a lot of other allegations started to come out. And one of the most striking was that the press office was actually watering down press releases. And you may recall the story of one of these key players was a young man who'd worked for the Bush campaign. And he wasn't only trying to spin global warming, but he was also making sure that every time NASA mentioned the Big Bang, it was also referred to as a theory. So he resigned after a blogger revealed that he'd apparently lied on his resume about being a college graduate.
Well, now NASA's Inspector General has released its report. What more does it have to say about what was going on?
Well, first of all, it says essentially all of those allegations are true. But the Inspector General also said that this was not an agency-wide plot, as some people had feared, but largely the result of a few out-of-control people in the news office who were trying to spin the NASA results to really help the Bush administration. And the people in question, by the way, were not career employees, but people who really served at the pleasure of the Bush administration.
And what specific examples did the Inspector General find at the press office?
Well, there's a pretty good list. One example is the press office delayed the release of a press report of a results from an ozone monitoring satellite. The explanation that they gave in internal documents was that they didn't want to put out bad news right before the November 2004 election. So those results came out in December 2004 instead of October of 2004. Another one was the Inspector General found the news office put dull-sounding headlines on some press releases in the hopes that people wouldn't read into them and find out that actually there might be more interesting stuff in the press release than the headline suggested. And maybe the strangest instance had nothing to do about climate change. It was a press release about a dead solar system elsewhere in the galaxy, and it was edited so references to our own solar system were removed. And the reason, according to the internal memos, was that the press office didn't want to, quote, be frightening the public with doom and gloom scenarios.
Sounds pretty wide-ranging, Richard. How much of this affected what the public actually learned about climate change and climate change research?
Well, the Inspector General says that it actually didn't have much an effect on that because the press office could really only get to the press releases and the related websites and so on that they control. But the reality is that's not the only source of information from NASA by any means, and science journalists may look at a press release to sort of get an idea of what's interesting. But if we find something that's interesting, we don't necessarily read the press release all that carefully. We go to the scientific papers and we read the papers to see what the papers actually say. Plus, when the scientists have an opportunity to talk to us, if we decide to go off and do a story, they're not constrained by what the press office has to say. So, might also mention that a lot of climate science isn't handled by NASA at all. A lot of it's universities and other federal agencies and so on. So there's a huge body of science out there that NASA press office has no control over whatsoever.
Except in this one case of the scientist who was prohibited from talking, as you mentioned.
That's right.
What did the Inspector General have to say about scientific research at NASA and the effects on that?
Well, it said, and I quote, "We found no evidence indicating that NASA blocked or interfered with the actual research activities of climate change scientists." And I might add that when you look, the scientist in question, James Hansen, actually remains one of the most outspoken and articulate people in the whole world of climate science. So it appears that NASA really has cleaned up its act here.
And briefly, other changes at NASA that have addressed these concerns?
Well, they have. They went through a whole job of trying to clean it up and change the procedures and so on. And the Inspector General's office says it appears as though those were successful.
Okay. NPR's Richard Harris, thanks so much.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.